Okay, good. So I would just start with some background on UML. So yeah, the UML is a, as I said already, visual modeling notation for object-oriented systems, which allows you to take different views on a system and to take a high degree of abstraction. It's a de facto industry standard, and it has standard extension mechanisms, these stereotypes which I mentioned already. So this is what UML looks like. Probably have seen UML in some sense already. Just well, different kinds of diagrams which allow you to specify different kinds of views on a system. And what I'm using here is just a fragment of UML, not the complete notation. And this is, well, this is important if you want to provide tool support, because the UML as notation altogether is quite a big notation and can be quite a complicated notation if you want to use every aspect of the notation. The specification document is about 800 pages. I'm not sure if many people have read them all. Probably only the poor guys who have to provide tool support for the UML, or the people who wrote them probably. anyway, so yeah, it's a big notation, but I think in practice you usually only use a relatively small part of it. And this is all, you can see that there are also a couple of good books which are actually which make a point in only presenting a part of that, such as the UML Distilled book by Martin Fowler. So, this is sort of more the style, the direction that I'm also using UML here. So I'm not trying to use every aspect. It would be possible in principle to use all the aspects with this approach, but it would be quite a lot of work if you want to provide tool support which supports all the aspects of UML. And therefore, well, it makes a lot of sense just to concentrate on the aspects which you really need. So firstly, I'm using most but not all of the diagram kinds. Firstly, use case diagrams allow you to write down and to discuss the requirements of a system with the customers or between the developers. Then class diagrams allow you to specify the data structure of the system. State chart diagrams allow you to specify the dynamic component behavior. Activity diagrams you can use to specify the flow of control between different components, and sequence diagrams you can use to model interaction between components using this message exchange. Then deployment diagrams are used to specify the physical environment of the system, and packages or subsystems you can use to collect together different diagrams for a given part of the system, which then specify the different views on that system. And the current version of UML 1.5 is still 1.5 released last year, but you probably heard that UML 2.0 is almost finalized. I think this should be like any day now. So they have in the process, they have narrowed down to one of the different proposals for quite some time now, and now they're just cleaning up the last bits in this specification document. So there's already a draft available. But here, on what I'm using here in this tutorial is really mainly independent of whether we want to use 1.5 or 2.0, but in the end I will say a little bit about what UML 2.0 would add to this approach. But anyway, the changes are backward compatible in the sense that that we are concerned with. So So firstly, a couple of words on the different kinds of diagrams, although I assume that you've seen them already. Just as a reminder, Firstly, to specify the data structure of the system, one can use class diagrams, and these consist of rectangles representing the different class models in the system, and these can be connected by relations such as inheritance relation or also dependency relations, and then so this allows you to specify in which relation the different objects should be in within the system. And objects, of course, can have attributes and also offer operations or signals, and yeah, so these are the main points you can use. And here we already see these stereotypes and this, the checked values, and I will say a little bit more about that in a couple of slides. And secondly, state charts. Well, these are just the state machines, the sort of Moodle Mealy automata, which we know for quite some time now, and then more specifically based on Harel's state charts. So these consist of different states which are connected by transitions, and whenever a transition is fired, because a message arrives and a condition is fulfilled, then an action will be executed, and we get to the new state. Then activity diagrams are similar to state charts, except that in activity diagrams you can specify the behavior of different objects or components, and that way get some kind of control flow between these objects or components. And for that you need mechanisms to specify and at which points they should synchronize. Yes, but and otherwise they're really similar to state charts, except that here, of course, then you have to partition the set of states into the states that belong to different kinds of objects or components using these so-called swim lanes. Then sequence diagrams, there you have different kinds of objects or components in the top line of the diagram. You have lifelines under these objects or components, and then they can exchange messages, these objects, which you write on these arrows. So these are here a bit complicated looking messages, because that's from a specific example which we will see later again, but at this point we don't have to worry about what this these labels, how these are exactly defined, but the point is only that you have message names and then you have arguments, and here you may specify conditions that have to hold so that the diagram can be executed further. Then we have deployment diagrams. These allow you to specify nodes in the system. These are these boxes which may be connected by physical communication links, and on nodes you may have components which are connected by communication dependencies. And this way you can describe the relation between the logical and the physical layer in the system. And you can put together different kinds of diagrams for a specific part in the system using so-called packages. So this is the package is just this frame around the different kinds of diagrams. And yeah, this way you can specify different views on a given system part, such as the physical view, the coordination, the different dynamic behaviors, and the data structure. And as I mentioned already, we will use the UML extension mechanisms. Firstly, these are the so-called stereotypes. These are labels in double angle brackets, which which allow you to mark a specific model element, and in that way you can specialize this model element and give it a specific meaning. So as we saw earlier, there was a dependency arrow, which was a sort of broken arrow from one component to the other, and there was a call stereotype written on it, and this meant that more specifically this dependency should be a call dependency, meaning that the one component should be able to call the other component. This is how a stereotype works. But you can also define your own stereotypes, and that's really what we will be doing here in this this tutorial. And then with each stereotype you can associate two kind of information. Firstly, tagged values, and these are also a sort of label but written in curly brackets, and so of the form a tag equals value. Meaning, and that way you can associate with a certain stereotype, you can associate certain data. So, for example, we will see a stereotype critical data, and there you can have tags which where the tag names are the different kinds of requirements or critical requirements, such as real time and so on. And the values there are then the attributes of the different objects that have that should satisfy these critical critical requirements. And this is then associated with the critical data stereotype. And that way you can well, include data, well, more specific data in the diagrams. And the second thing that is associated with stereotypes is the are the constraints. And these then can refine the semantics of the element which carries a stereotype with a more precise meaning. And the constraints, well, in principle you could write down any kind of constraint in whatever notation you like, but in this context here, since we want to analyze the diagrams with automated tools afterwards, we use as constraints, we use first order predicate logic, because these we can then translate in our tool support to automated theorem provers and then evaluate that the constraints are actually fulfilled. But again, these constraints, this is not what the user of this approach should use, but this is really what we as the a developer of this approach had to use in order to enable our tool support to analyze the diagrams for the requirements that are included as stereotypes. So this is, these constraints are usually not visible on the user level, but only on the developer, well, on the level. So they're not visible on the level of the user of this approach, who may of course be developers, but they are only visible at the level of the developers of this approach. And if you gather together all this kind of information for a certain application domain, such as safe or secure systems, then what this is called a profile. So, yeah, so this is the general introduction about UML. Any questions at this part? Yeah, I will now start with the sort of part on the security extension. So firstly, yeah, you may wonder what the problems are here specifically in security. The problem here is that although people have been worrying about computer security for quite some time now, and although there are actually quite some useful and secure tools which you can use as a programmer to build your system, such as cryptographic algorithms, encryption, signature, and so on, and also security protocols and so on, the problem is that it's not easy to use these mechanisms within the system that is supposed to be developed. And the successful attacks in practice usually attack not the mechanisms themselves, such as the cryptographic algorithms, because these are just usually just sufficiently secure, and a usual adversary would not be able to break them. But instead, they attack the way that these mechanisms are used within the system. So the boundaries between a security protocol and the system environment, for example. And this is sort of signified in this picture here. There you can see a road, and there's a bar on the road which should keep cars from going through the road, but unfortunately this is not securely integrated in the road, the security mechanism, and therefore the cars simply left the street and drove around the bar and could go through the street anyway. This is sort of the example which you find a lot in computer security. People use some kind of mechanism such as cryptography, but they don't use it in a way which is then secure. So, and this is slightly worryingly also something if you use the web to do like e-commerce, if you want to buy something or so, you sometimes see at the websites, they sort of reassure you that you can send them their credit card number because they use SSL, and of course this is a secure protocol and everything is fine, but unfortunately this is not sufficient because hackers can still break into, or maybe be able to break into the back end, the database, and get all the credit card number anyway, although they use SSL to protect the communication between the user and the company. So this is really a sort of short thinking if these websites state that. So firstly, start with some basic security requirements which will be we will use in the UML extension. The point is again, as I mentioned already, that you have a couple of security requirements which come up a lot, and therefore it makes sense, or it's even just possible to define them precisely and to include them in the diagrams using these stereotype labels. So the first of them is the secrecy or confidentiality requirement, and this means that information should not be leaked out to unauthorized parties in the system. So these requirements are always formulated relative to some kind of adversary model, and this may actually depend on what the actual requirement or the actual system is. And sometimes even users of the system can be potential adversaries or attackers. And this is often the case where, for example, people use smart cards, such as in smart card-based electronic purse systems. Another example is the pay TV systems, where people get their own decoders at home and in order to view pay TV, and there are the owners of such decoders are potential adversaries because they may try to sort of break into the decoder and from then on view TV without paying for the pay TV. This shows that it's important to consider who the actual adversary is, and secondly that sometimes the adversary is a legitimate user of the system. This is in each case when we worry about these security requirements, we have to always consider against whom these requirements could hold. So this is the case for secrecy, as I explained, and then secondly, integrity is sort of the dual requirement, so there the flow of information in a different direction should be stopped, namely their unauthorized parties should not be able to change information in the way that they are not allowed to do. So this is sort of going inwards to this information in whatever component this sits on. And then availability is the requirement that the access to the information should always be granted in a sufficiently a high degree. Then, so two more advanced requirements are those of authenticity and non-reputability. Authenticity means that certain information should be bound, also should have its sender information associated with it, in the sense that it should not be possible to for someone to create some information, such as an electronic contract, and then later to say that this was created by someone else. So someone should not be able to sign a contract with my name and claim that I actually signed the contract. And this is, well, this is an example for a security requirement which you also, of course, need to have in the physical world, like the paper and pencil world. And there, well, of course, and this is based on handwritten signatures, which I hope not to be forgeable. But the problem is, if you move then to the electronic world, things get more difficult, because in the physical world you have certain objects which are not easy to duplicate. So if you have a contract, of course, you can put it on your copy machine, but then usually the signature will not be copied in a way that that does not allow you to distinguish between the original and the copy. I mean, usually, of course, with modern copy machines, this is also blurring this distinction. But yeah, you can still look at the imprint of the handwriting on the paper, and if there's no, you know, there's no, if you can see that this was just printed on it by a printer and not written by hand, then this is gives you proof that the for example, the contract is a copy or not the original. But in the electronic world, bits are just bits, and the whole electronic world is based on the fact that you can copy one bit from one part of the computer to another part and between computers. So this is really something you need, and that's where the whole problem starts. This is obviously a problem if you want to design electronic cache systems. In the real world, the assumption is that if you have one piece of money, this just by having this piece of money, this doesn't give you the potential to copy this and to have $2 instead of $1 note. But in the electronic world, to start with the basic situation, this is exactly what would happen. If you have one bit, of course you can make two bits out of it, and you can also create your own bit very easy, bit sequences very easily, and that's why computer security is so difficult compared to security in the real world, although that is already difficult enough. And the second kind of advanced security requirement is that of non-reputability. And this sort of again goes in a different direction. There, the information should be bound with the sender in the way that if I signed a contract, I should later not be able to deny that I signed the contract. And so these are the two requirements which sort of bind together the sender of information with the information in the two directions. So now if we worry about what the requirements for UML are, if you want to extend UML to be used for secure systems development, and by the way, what I say now about the security extension, this really holds quite a parallel about the safety extension, which I will talk in the second half of the tutorial. but why I would just start with the security part here. And the goal is now, as I said already, to be able to include basic security requirements within the UML specification using stereotypes, and these are the basic security requirements which are just explained, such as secrecy and integrity and so on. And secondly, the extension should allow the user to consider different kinds of adversaries. Some developers have to worry about the usual adversary, the usual hacker, which may try to hack a website or something in that direction. And you may, on the other end of the scale, you may have someone developing systems that are used in the military, and they have to worry about a foreign nation trying to break into the computers. And of course, then the adversary strength is much higher. So you then have to worry about other people even constructing dedicated hardware to break certain encryption keys. And so this is, of course, a quite different scenario. And it should be possible to distinguish between these scenarios within this approach, and also should be possible to base the analysis of the specifications on the different kinds of scenarios, or the different kinds of adversary strength, firstly, and then secondly also threat scenarios, in the sense that the adversary may be able to access different parts of the system and may be prevented from accessing other parts just by physical means, because they are in a room which is locked or whatever. And this should, you should also be able to distinguish between these kind of situations. Then, of course, in security, there are various existing concepts which you would also want to use in the context of such a specification and analysis approach, such as tamper-resistant hardware, like smart cards, where people or the usual adversaries would be assumed not to be able to break into these components. And this you should also be able to reflect in the UML model, and also in the analysis tool. And a similar thing with the certain security mechanisms that have already been developed, such as access control. Then on a more technical level, this approach has to provide certain security primitives, such as cryptographic algorithms for the users of this approach to include in the diagrams, because this is often a source of potential vulnerabilities that cryptographic algorithms are not used correctly in the system context. So you would want to be able to specify in which way these algorithms are supposed to be used within the system. So this UML extension notation should also provide the possibility for specifying this. And then, as I said already, this security analyses are always performed relative to the underlying physical security. So if there's tamper-resistant hardware, for example, which a given adversary is assumed not to be able to break, then this is an effect on the physical security level, which you have to be you take into consideration for the tool support that is supposed to analyze the specification for these requirements. And something else which is also important is you should be able to address the interface between the computer and the human user, because this is also a source of many problems. It's not sufficient if the computer or the system you developed itself is secure, but on the interface between the system and the human users, there are certain problems such that the user will make certain mistakes, and that way the system will be used in an insecure way. And so that way you also have to be able to take this into consideration by sort of, for example, specifying a secure workflow for the system and analyze that when the user follows the secure workflow, whether the system will then be secure in interaction with the human user. Then optionally, it would be also be nice if you could, if you had a certain domain-specific security knowledge already included in the approach, and its examples are Java security, smart cards, or proper security. And it would also be good if the advanced users of this approach would be able to extend the notation with new stereotypes which they define themselves, and also should be as easy as possible for them to then also to extend the tool support with mechanisms that check these newly defined stereotypes. So now the general ideas of this security extension of UML are sort of, well, close to, well, if you look at the different kinds of diagrams, in each case one would say that whatever the diagram is used in the usual use of UML for developing systems, we now want to use them for the security critical aspects of this view of the system. So activity diagrams are for coordinating different components, and now therefore we want to use it for making this coordination secure. Class diagrams, there you, well, of course, you said already, you specify the data structure. So now here we want to use them to make sure that the data structure respects the security requirements or the security levels of the different data that is included in the system. And then sequence diagrams, well, you use sequence diagrams to specify interaction between different components or objects, and now we want to be able to use them to make sure that this interaction is secure. Similar stage diagrams want to use to make sure that the security within one object is preserved, so the behavior of one single object is actually secure in the sense that, for example, it does not send out any confidential information. And deployment diagrams we want to use to specify the physical security of the level of the system, and also the requirements that should apply to this level. And lastly, then packages allow you again to put together all these diagrams, and we're using them here to allow us to take a view on the system, which allows you to make a security analysis, which is really holistic in the sense that you sort of you are able to put all these different aspects into a relation. So the point is that it's not sufficient to, in each case, make sure that each of these aspects themselves are secure, but you then have to put together all these kind of diagrams and all these different aspects and make sure that the big picture on the whole is then secure on the whole. Because the problem is that if you, since you have to worry about motivated adversaries, they will always try to find the weakest link in the system, and this is often the boundaries, either the physical or the conceptual boundaries between the different parts or different layers of the system. And so we have to make sure that at these boundaries there are no breaks that are not analyzed with respect to security, because that's where the weaknesses may lie, and this is certainly something that the adversaries would find given sufficient time and motivation. So just a short overview on the profile. How does such a profile look like? In principle, it's such a table which you can see on this slide, and I will explain all these entries on the next couple of slides, so you don't have to understand them here now, but just to see the big picture. In principle, such a profile for security or safety or whatever is a table where in the left column you have the different new stereotypes that you want to define for this extension. So in this case, this is the internet stereotype, the secure link stereotype, and so on. And in each case, you have to define to which kind of model elements these stereotypes should apply. So for example, internet stereotype you can assign to communication links, the secure link stereotype you can attach to subsystems, and so on. The third kind of thing you can attach here is, as I said earlier, that for stereotypes you can associate tags which allow you to add more data to the system. So for example, for the no downflow stereotype you can add this PI tag, which allows you to specify a certain data or certain attribute in the system, and I will explain in a couple of slides how this works exactly. As I mentioned already, also there are different. You can define constraints that have to hold in order that the stereotype is correctly attached to a certain model element. And here, these constraints are simply described in English language. But as I said already, in the tool-based approach that I'm presenting here, we formalize the constraints in first-order logic, and this allows us to use automated theorem provers to establish that they are actually fulfilled in a given UML diagram. And in the last column, there's just some short description of these different kinds of stereotypes. This is just to get an overview of this extension. And now I will explain these different kinds of stereotypes in more detail. So, firstly, we have a few stereotypes that allow you to specify the different kinds of communication links or system nodes, in the sense that you want to be able to say in which sense these should be implemented in the physical world. This is important because on this it depends how an adversary would be able to attack this, the different links or nodes. And there are different examples here, but of course there are many more types of communication links and system nodes, but I just give some for explanation here. Firstly, the a communication link can of course be an internet link. Then you just attach this internet stereotype to the communication link in the deployment diagram. And then the question is, what does this mean with respect to the security analysis? On the next couple of slides, whenever I say something about security constraints, this is always formulated relative to a given adversary type. This may be, for example, the default adversary, that is just a adversary with the usual kind of knowledge which someone would have who wants to attack a system, and that may also be different kinds of adversary types, such as an insider adversary who is actually a user, a legitimate user of the system, or an adversary with a higher kind of strength. And well, next couple of slides I will just mostly look at the default adversary, so I will just shortly give some examples on what the adversary would be able to do with respect to certain physical links or system nodes. And this we can define using these threat sets. So for a given adversary type and a given stereotype, such as the internet stereotype and the default adversary, one has a set of threats that these are the actions that the given adversary type is able to do with respect to the system node or the communication link. So in the case of an internet communication link, the default adversary should be able to, or is assumed to be able to delete the information that is exchanged over an unprotected internet communication link, because this is actually relatively easy to do in practice, to delete certain information that is exchanged. And secondly, the default adversary will also be able to read the information that is exchanged over an unprotected internet link, and also to insert information over information into this communication link. And this is sort of then specified in this threat sets. In this way, we can sort of define the different kinds of adversary models that we may worry about with respect to a given system. This way we will only be able to find problems that are actually visible on the level of the system model. So because this adversary model is of course defined on the level of the system specification, and in this case, with the kind of threats which I explained on the slide, for example, you would not be able to, you would not be able to detect which kinds of attacks an adversary could do on the hardware level, for example. The point is, once people find out what kind of attacks an adversary could do, such as in the case of smart cards, at some point people realize that you may be able to apply power analysis to smart cards, where based on the power consumption of a smart card, you can actually compute the data that is stored on the smart card and which is used in this the computations, without actually breaking up the smart card, or without doing any legitimate thing to the smart card. And this is something which people at some point just realized and were not able before, aware before. And of course, these kind of attacks you can only detect by actually taking the hardware and trying to attack it in a physical way. And you cannot find these attacks using this kind of model-based approach. But the point is, once you realize that such an attack is there, you can then incorporate this in this adversary model by saying, okay, a certain kind of sophisticated adversary may be able to apply these power analysis attacks and then be able to read out information from a smart card, although this is not, with standard adversaries, this is not assumed to be possible. So this is sort of the relation between the physical real security in the real world and the security analysis which we are doing here with respect to the system specification, of course. Different examples are, well, of course, you, instead of having an internet communication link, you might also have an encrypted communication link, where the adversary would then not be able to read the information or to insert new information, but just be able to delete information from certain communication links, and you well, a certain kind of communication link is the local area network, and there the default adversary that is not assumed to be an insider of the system would usually not be able to even delete the information. So the point why